Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 13, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group Teleform Conference Call. On this Teleform Conference Call, a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform, we'll be discussing today's U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Myriad Human DNA patent case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note, as always, that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. Also, I want to let you know that our expert on today's call, Professor Gregory Dolan, filed an amicus brief in this case on the side of Myriad. Finally, as a final note, atypically for these calls, this call is open to the press, so please know that. Our expert on today's call, I mentioned, is Professor Gregory Dolan from the University of Baltimore School of Law. Professor Dolan is co-director of the newly created Center for Medicine and Law at the Law School, which is a partnership between the University of Baltimore Law and the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His center supports collaboration between experts in the fields of both medicine and law and focuses its efforts on an examination of medical and legal issues from the perspective of the healthcare practitioner. Professor Dolan was good enough to participate in our Teleform conference call when the Myriad case was argued, and we're happy to welcome him back to discuss the Supreme Court's decision today. His full bio is on our website, so I'm not going to elaborate any further. We're going to hear opening remarks from Professor Dolan of about 20 minutes, and then we'll take questions from the audience. And with that, Professor Dolan, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Thanks again for having me back to talk about Myriad case. I'll begin by referring to what Dean mentioned, that I was actually at the oral argument, and I think back then when I sort of was asked for my reaction, I kind of suggested that the court is likely to adopt the view of the Solicitor General because, judging from the oral argument, I think the justices were concerned with sort of the extreme positions taken by attorneys for either side or both sides, as well as they were concerned about their own ability to fully grasp the scientific issues. And I think ultimately, that's how it came out. Ultimately, the Supreme Court chose the position advocated by the United States amicus, and argued by Solicitor General Verrilli. So in some ways, today's decision is not surprising. At this point, let me take a sort of a step back and explain how the case came to be, what was ultimately the question presented, and how Supreme Court resolved it. So this case was filed a few years ago by Association for Molecular Pathology and a number of physicians and scientists working in the area of genetics, specifically working with this gene BRCA1 and BRCA2 that code for breast and ovarian cancer. Specifically, mutations in those genes make it more likely that a person carrying those mutations will develop breast or ovarian cancer. The case was litigated in Southern District of New York before Judge Sweet, and Judge Sweet ultimately concluded on summary judgment that neither the claims to isolated DNA nor claims to cDNA, which appeared in various of Myriad's patents, were patent eligible. Judge Sweet, just take a step back, Myriad got these patents roughly 17 years ago. Their priority date goes back to 1995, so these patents are actually quite old, and it sort of bears remembering that however this case would have come out, Myriad's patents are set to expire in about 15 or so months. So Myriad's patents cover two specific types of molecules. One, they covered isolated DNA, which is essentially a portion of DNA excised from a chromosome, but not otherwise modified. So you take a whole chromosome, you excise it, you break some chemical bonds, and that's what they patented. The other set of claims that Myriad had went to cDNA. And cDNA essentially is a molecule that contains only the coding regions of DNA, only those regions that actually code for amino acids and ultimately proteins. It's a mystery of nature as to why humans and other animals carry in their DNA a variety of non-coding regions, but that's what they do. And so when scientists ultimately work with DNA, they have to figure out which regions are relevant in coding and which ones are not. And so Myriad did figure that out, and so they filed separate claims on cDNA. Judge Sweet, in his opinion in Southern District of New York, decided that neither of those claims is patent eligible on this theory that DNA is an information-carrying molecule, and whether you excise it wholesale from a chromosome or whether you excise it and modify it, you don't really change the information-carrying capacity, and therefore there's no addition beyond that which nature has wrought itself that would make the molecule eligible for a patent. The case was taken on appeal to the Federal Circuit. It was a three-judge panel, Judge Lurie, Judge Moore, and Judge Bryson. The panel split 2-1, but with three separate opinions. Judge Lurie and Judge Moore concluded that Judge Sweet was wrong, and so they reversed him on at least on those claims about isolated DNA and cDNA, while Judge Bryson concluded that only cDNA should be patent eligible. He said that isolated DNA looks exactly like what we have in nature. The mere fact that you take it out of a chromosome and break certain chemical bonds is not enough. And but cDNA, because it's further modified, he thought it was enough. Cert was sought, granted, and the judgment was vacated and remanded to the Supreme Court, back to the Federal Circuit, to reconsider the opinion in light of intervening Supreme Court decision in Prometheus versus Mayo that happened last year. Federal Circuit again took the case and again split exactly the same way. In fact, the opinions, the first Federal Circuit opinion and second Federal Circuit opinion, don't differ all that markedly from one another. So it was again 2-1, with Judge Lurie and Judge Moore concluding that both isolated DNA and cDNA are patent eligible. Judge Bryson saying only cDNA is patent eligible. Cert was sought again and granted again, and so today we have the opinion from the Supreme Court. One small footnote that I'll add is that there were also other claims directed to methods of diagnosing the condition in actual patients, and those were also invalidated by Judge Sweet because they were too abstract. That invalidation of specific methods as to how to use those DNA molecules that invalidation was upheld by the Federal Circuit and was not addressed by the Supreme Court. So certain methods, because they were not described in sufficient specificity, but only at a very abstract level, those were invalidated as well. So today we have this opinion where, again, the court ultimately followed what Judge Bryson did and what Solicitor General's office recommended and concluded that only cDNA are patent eligible, but excised and so isolated DNA is not. And the opinion is surprisingly short and surprisingly unanimous. So last time Supreme Court talked about, in broad strokes, about patent eligibility was in a case a few years ago called Bilski versus Kappas. They had a couple of intervening cases in between, but that was sort of the last big one. And that, although the outcome was unanimous, 9-0, the court split fairly deeply, 5-4, on the question of on the scope of the opinion as to why that particular claim it issued Bilski was ineligible. And it was a very long opinion, if I recall. It was if you take sort of concurrences and majority, and there were several concurrences there. I think it ran close to 100 pages, something like that. I may be exaggerating a little bit, but in that general area. Today's opinion was about 15 or 17 pages. So it's a very short and very sort of to the point. And in fact, majority of the opinion actually goes to describe the underlying science in fairly clear terms as opposed to the legal analysis. So that was a bit of a surprise that there was not more sort of not more either dissent or more concurrences or sort of more splintered opinion. The court ultimately, like I said, sided with Judge Bryson and Solicitor General's office and concluded that isolated DNA is not patent eligible on this theory that merely breaking chemical bonds doesn't change anything because the sequence of DNA, whether isolated or whether remaining in the chromosome, doesn't change. So the court's conclusion was that because the sequence doesn't change, it's the same molecule, it simply becomes a smaller part versus sort of being some part of something larger. The court, in Justice Thomas' opinion by Justice Thomas, the court said something, once we're discussing it, said something quite odd, though. They said that the reason we're not focusing on this sort of breaking of chemical bonds is because Myriad didn't claim their sequence of DNA as a chemical molecule, so by writing out a chemical formula. They claimed it as a sequence, which seems odd to me because the sequence does determine chemical structure and vice versa. And to the extent that, you know, if you take that sentence seriously, it means that all that patentees would have to do is simply rewrite their claims not in terms of sequence, but in terms of actual chemical formula and using particular modifier, specifically consisting of, as opposed to comprising, and I'll get back to that in a second, and then their claims will be patent eligible. So just to get to this consistent comprising issue, in patent law, you can claim, when you claim your invention, you can use several phrases. If you say comprising of, it means all the elements that I list and possibly others that people might add. So for example, if I claim a chair, I say comprising a seat and three legs, simply because somebody adds also a back into the chair, that still would be infringing because it would still have a seat and three legs. But if I use the phrase consisting of, that means that which I describe and nothing else. So any additions would get it out of the scope of my patent. So if one takes Justice Thomas's turn of phrase seriously, saying that if you claim it as a chemical molecule and use the term consisting of, meaning no other additions, then somehow you get over this bar Supreme Court set today, it's just odd. The other oddity in Justice Thomas's opinion is that when he talks about isolated DNA, again, DNA that's simply cut out of a chromosome but not otherwise modified, he talks about isolated DNA. He does focus a bit on the information carrying capacity of DNA. He says, look, it's the same basic molecule. There's the same thing, other than the fact that you've cut it out of a larger molecule, nothing has really changed. But when he switches to talk about cDNA, even though, again, everybody agrees that the cDNA's information-carrying function, even though it's difficult, different chemical molecule because non-coding regions have been excised, but precisely because only non-coding regions have been excised, the information-carrying capacity of cDNA is exactly the same. And yet, in barely two paragraphs, Justice Thomas says, well, it's a different molecule. It involves human interaction between what sort of nature made and what sort of humans cut out on versus what they left in, and therefore that is patent eligible. So it's an odd switch when, you know, talking about one molecule, he sort of focuses more on information carrying capacity, and another molecule simply says, well, lots of human modification, therefore patent eligible. Not doesn't exist in nature, therefore patent eligible. So there's some inconsistencies between the sort of the mode of analysis in the opinion. In terms of my reaction to it, my sort of basic reaction, and as Dean mentioned, I filed a brief in this case supporting Myriad's position and arguing that both native DNA and cDNA should have been held patent eligible. So in the interest of full disclosure, I wanted to mention that and sort of to say as a result, so I'm not fully happy with the court's opinion, but I do take the view that it could have been much worse. When the case was granted, I think there was serious concern, especially given how the court phrased the question presented. The question presented, if you recall, was phrased, are human genes patentable? And the reason why there was this concern over the way the question was presented is because everybody agrees, including myself, and again, like I said, I certainly supported Myriad throughout. Everybody agrees that human genes are not patentable because human genes are what we actually carry in our bodies. Certainly nobody invented those. What really Myriad claimed to have invented are those isolated pieces of DNA, not specific genes that are carried by live individuals out there. And so there was real concern that the Supreme Court is going to use this case to lay down a rule that because DNA is so unique, because it has this information-carrying capacity, that no DNA at all, whether cDNA, isolated DNA, or any other form, is patent eligible precisely because the genetic code is set, whether in humans or it's actually set interspecies. So a specific genetic code goes to specific amino acids, which then in turn make specific proteins. And luckily, from my perspective, the Supreme Court did not do that. They did not invalidate... They did not for foreclosed the ability of the patent office to grant patents on DNA, provided they're claimed properly, provided they're sort of modified more than minimally from what is present in nature. And it allowed, I think, it did not undercut the biotechnology industry. So from my perspective, it could have been much worse. I think Supreme Court took a cautious step. I wish they would have, you know, I think they wish it would have affirmed the Federal Circuit in its entirety. But ultimately, I think they didn't do too much damage, although that remains to be seen, depending on how this case is applied to future cases by the Federal Circuit and district courts. But what sort of strikes me as a bit odd, and that's precisely because I'm somewhat somewhat content with today's opinion. Strikes me a bit odd that opening up New York Times today, opening up some other online publications, I read the Supreme Court invalidated patents in human genes. And so I don't think that's what the Supreme Court did, because human genes were never patent eligible in the first place, and to the extent that it's just a shorthand for what Myriad actually had patented, the Supreme Court invalidated only a small part of their patents. And let me close by kind of where I started. I've been asked questions both after the initial argument and so and now, what impact will this have on biotechnology? What's sort of the take-home message in terms of not just patent law, but in terms of economics? And I think my answer is then, as it is now, is one, it's too soon to tell because we just don't know how science will evolve, and we don't know how the lower courts will apply the decision. But more importantly, what has to be remembered that Myriad patents are old patents. They were granted in, I believe, 98 or 97, something like that. I can pull them up. But they were going to expire in 2014. So no matter what the Supreme Court has ruled, and people who are claiming inventions in the DNA area today are generally not claiming in the same way that Myriad is somewhat a unique case. They're not claiming it in the same way as Myriad did. So in some ways, this decision may have fairly narrow application that will potentially invalidate some patents that were granted 15, 16, 17, 20 years ago, but may have very limited application to sort of to newer patents. But that remains to be seen. So I think I'll just stop there, and I'll look forward to your questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor. We are going to open the floor to questions from the audience in a moment. We'll all hear an announcement that'll say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Professor Gregory Dolan, push the pound button and then the star button on your telephone. Or press the star button and then the pound button, I'm sorry. So once again, if you have a question for the professor, our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see about questions, let me make a brief announcement. That is that the Supreme Court has another decision day on Monday. We've been waiting for some time for a decision in the Fisher case, and now I suppose the Shelby County case. The Fisher case, of course, is the affirmative action case. Shelby County is the Voting Rights Act case. If we get a decision out of the court on Monday, we will try to put together a courthouse steps edition of Teleform and host that for you on Monday. Today, of course, we're talking about the Myriad case with Professor Gregory Dolan. Let's go to our first question from the audience.
Hi, Greg. This is Ilya Shapiro from Cato. Thanks for the preview of what you're going to write in the Cato Supreme Court review this fall, I guess.
Thanks for reminding me that I have a bunch of assignments hanging over my head.
Right. I'm not a patent or IP scholar, but it seems like the last few cases, and this continues it, they speak with almost always unanimously and try to kind of have a cautious middle way so as not to interfere with potential future technological developments that they can't predict and really throw a monkey wrench into innovation. And I think this decision, like others, there's a lot of commentators on both sides that kind of view it as sort of half a loaf, you know, this didn't seem to do too much damage. Is there something good or bad about this sort of development? I mean, should the court just stop taking these cases because they don't really do much with them when they get them? Or Is it that they're not taking good enough advice from IP academics or practitioners or the biotechnology industry? I'm trying to kind of make sort of sense of long-term trends in this area.
Well, let me do to you what Supreme Court has did to the rest of us. So I'll agree in part and disagree in part. So I think you're right that they are trying to thread the needle in some of these cases. For example, in Bilski, they had an opportunity to say that business method patents are never – business method claims are never patent eligible. Here they had an opportunity to say that DNA claims are never patent eligible, and they decided not to do that. That said, the last opinion that they wrote prior to Myriad in Prometheus, which came down, I believe, last April, but last term, they actually wrote a very broad opinion by Justice Breyer. It was unanimous. It was fairly short. And I think that opinion, if it's read for all that it is or that purports to be, I think was actually extraordinarily broad and would have changed the law tremendously. It's interesting that there's almost no reference or complete no reference in Myriad to Prometheus, precisely because Prometheus was so strongly criticized in academic press and other circles, because Justice Breyer took an extraordinarily broad view of how much things can be excluded from patent eligibility under Section 101 as opposed to other sections of the patent law. So I think as a result, perhaps you're right, the Supreme Court has retrenched to sort of this more accurate, more kind of half a loaf type mode, but I don't think that has always been the case even in the last few years. The other sort of caution that I would make is that, again, going back to Bilski, they have not really spoken unanimously always. Again, in Bilski, for example, yes, the ultimate result that Bilski's particular claims are not patent eligible was 9-0, but if you recall, the court actually split 5-4 with Justice Kennedy writing for majority saying these claims are not patent eligible, but we're not going to say that business methods are never patent eligible, where Justice Stevens wrote for the four justices, quote-unquote, concurrence, but really was almost a dissent, arguing that business method claims should never be patent eligible. So in some ways, today's opinion is perhaps the first in that line that actually is both unanimous and takes a fairly narrow approach, because previous ones have been – there's been some serious movement to either speak broadly or actually have spoken broadly, only perhaps to come to regret it. I'll just sort of conclude by saying that, to the extent that we have to live with these opinions, I would much prefer them to be much more narrow, because the court, as Justice Scalia notes in his short concurrence, the court really doesn't know and understand science, and it's dangerous for the court to make broad pronouncements without knowing science as it exists today, much less as what will exist like tomorrow.
I had to put Ilya Shapiro on mute because we were getting some background noise. Let me unmute him now and see if he has a follow-up.
No, that's fine. I want to hear some more questions from people who actually practice and know more about this area. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Ilya. If you have a question, if you want to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. Professor Dolan, you alluded to the level of knowledge of science in the court and maybe found it somewhat wanting. Certainly, prospectively, what's going to be discovered, maybe very few of us know that. Does in your estimation, does the expertise of the court vary between the Supreme Court and the Court of Claims, for example, or
It's hard to say, and so I clerk on the Federal Circuit, and so I have tremendous respect for all the judges there. So what I'm about to say should be by no means interpreted as me being somehow derisive of the expertise there. But, with that caveat, about half the judges on the Federal Circuit, the court that actually is specifically dedicated to deal with patent law issues, actually don't have patent law background. For example, Judge Bryson, who ultimately ended up being right in this case and who, again, I have tremendous respect for. I think he's a wonderful judge. But he came to the court from a criminal law background. He was a chief, I believe, of the criminal law section of the DOJ. Chief Judge Rader, who, again, is a wonderful judge, but he came mostly from, I think, he had a congressional career. He worked for Senator Hatch. That's not to say they don't understand patent law and they can't do it, and because they certainly do it and they do it well, but it's not as if the Federal Circuit has this tremendous area of expertise in every particular area of science that comes in front of them. To the extent they do have that expertise, it simply comes from dealing with, you know, lots and lots and lots of patent cases. And because these are very smart individuals, very hardworking individuals, they learn those intricacies that Supreme Court simply doesn't learn. I mean, everybody now says that Supreme Court has taken real interest in patent cases, but that really means that they have decided about five or six patent cases over the last few years, as opposed to Federal Circuit deciding five or six cases, patent cases a day. So,
what accounts for, in your mind, accounts for the increase in the Supreme Court's interest here? Do they feel the Federal Circuit's getting it wrong, or is it easy to tell?
Well, I think it's hard to tell. I mean, obviously, Federal Circuit gets reversed often enough, but then, you know, there's an old adage, Supreme Court doesn't take cases to affirm. I think part of it is that Federal Circuit has kind of been left alone for about 20 or so years after its creation to see if they can bring some sort of order to patent law that used to be somewhat disparate across various regions of the country when it was administered by the regional circuits. And now that we have some sort of solid basis in patent law, I think Supreme Court is trying to make sure the Federal Circuit gets supervised just like other circuits so that they don't go too much off in one particular direction without appropriate guidance from the Supreme Court. So, but to get back to your original question, I think there's more expertise in patent law in places like Court of Claims, Federal Circuit, places like maybe Eastern District of Texas, where a lot of cases are filed, District of Delaware, but not because those judges necessarily know science better, just because they happen to have dealt with many more patent cases than any of the Supreme Court justices have had to deal with.
All right. Let's go back to the audience. We've got two questions pending at this point. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, my name is Jim Ewing, and I'm a private patent practitioner. I don't practice in this area. I practice in electronics. However, I read on page 7 of the opinion that isolation is necessary to conduct genetic testing, and Myriad was not the only entity to offer BRCA testing after it discovered the genes. The text talks about how Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania's GDL and others provided genetic testing services to women, and how plaintiff Osterer at NYU School of Medicine sent his DNA samples to GDL for testing. Mm-hmm. And then it talks about how Myriad sent letters to them asserting that the genetic testing infringed Myriad's patents. And my question is this, after the isolation of DNA claims were struck down by this court as invalid, but the synthesis of cDNA claims were upheld, would Myriad still have a basis to send those letters asking them to stop the genetic testing? Do the synthesis of cDNA claims that were upheld, are they required to do this genetic testing?
I think that will sort of depend on how particular lab does its genetic testing. So if they actually go ahead and they use cDNA, then I suppose Myriad can continue to send those letters. If they only use isolated DNA, then Myriad probably can't. Definitely can't. So I think it will really depend on what particular methods and what particular sort of tools a particular lab uses to conduct genetic testing. As you well know, the scope of Myriad's rights is bounded by the claim. And so what they've claimed is, and what was upheld is what's theirs. Anything outside of the claim is not. So if Pennsylvania or any other clinic now can find a way to test without cDNA as described in Myriad's patents, then they'll be free and clear of any infringement charges. And if they can't, then, you know, then they'll still be in the same boat as they were before. Beyond that, I don't know if I can necessarily give Myriad counsel legal advice on this line. I think it will very much depend on exactly what is happening in those labs that Myriad has accused of infringement.
We've got two questions pending. If you want to join the queue, again, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Well, this is Adam Ossoff. I'm professor of law at George Mason University School of Law and co-director of academic programs with the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. Greg, I enjoyed your presentation and your summary of the case and the decision. And I was curious to hear your thoughts on the issue in the court's analysis of the status of the BRCA1 and of the isolated BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, in which it characterized the act of separation as, quote, not an act of invention, unquote, which is a very strange thing to be talking about, I guess at the section 101 level, perhaps, because it seems to be building. They seem to be building into section 101 this, you know, a flash of genius type inquiry that the court has moved away from, and that of course Congress attempted in section 103 in the 1952 Patent Act to eliminate. So, do you have any concerns about this as well? That they're creating this kind of inventive step inquiry at the 101 level that is vague, incoherent, and ultimately will create too high of a bar for the type of patentable inventions that people are coming up with today?
Well, so let me, I think, and it's a great question, but let me sort of answer it in two parts. I think the good news is that, you know, it could have been worse. They could have sort of taken... pretty much parroted Prometheus, where the exactly what you've identified has happened, where Justice Breyer built into this non-obviousness, novelty, flash of genius type inquiry into 101. I think luckily or fortunately, the court didn't do that. That said, I think you're exactly right. They didn't step all the way back from that, what I view, and I think you agree that it's an erroneous type of analysis. That to the extent that we're going to inquire into novelty or non-obviousness, or even if we were to go back to this whole flash of genius idea, it still doesn't belong in 101. It belongs in 102, 103 analysis, which is it's done once we figure out that these claims are in fact eligible at the first instance. And so I think that's the good news, that, you know, they didn't go as far as they went just a year ago in Prometheus. I think the bad news is that you're exactly right. To the extent that this passage is going to be relied on and continue to be cited by either Supreme Court or lower courts, you're exactly right. It's incoherent, it's vague, and it opens the door to ad hoc analysis of inventions in the areas where people think are for whatever, and you can't see me, but I'm doing my scare air quotes, are different. The DNA is just different because it's the basis of life. Businesses are just different because that's just the way we run our economy. You know, and, drugs are different because we need them to, you know, to live. Or, all of these arguments I'm sure all of us have seen at one point or another. And to the extent that we have this sort of loose language that would allow judges to do just that, that does potentially scare me that... whenever somebody can make this creative, quote-unquote, different argument, that this is just something new and different and scary, a judge like Judge Sweet, who is sympathetic to that sort of analysis, and again, I'm not trying to say Judge Sweet is a terrible judge. I'm just saying that he sort of bought into this idea in this particular case. Judges like Judge Sweet might take that language and base their analysis and validation of patent claims under 101, especially on this sort of ill-defined analysis of inventive concept that the court seems to incorporate into 101.
Thank you.
All right, we have one question pending at this point. Again, if you want to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Greg. This is Robert Sachs from Fenwick & West. Appreciate the analysis. Quick question here. First, I think that there is the inventive concept certainly being brought into the analysis. It's not expressed really well here, but it's on page 8 where Thomas says the central question is whether isolation is an inventive act that entitles the individual who first isolated to a patent. So that really is Stephen's inventive concept test there. It's not so much the flash of genius, but certainly keeps alive this. My focus is on the very last sentence, the last paragraph of the decision, where they talk about the scientific alteration of genetic code presents a different inquiry, and we express no opinion on that. And here's the key one. We merely hold that genes and the information they encode are not patentable simply because they have been isolated. It would seem that even though they give a nod that if you make structural changes to the DNA, if you, for example, the cDNA, or if you add markers or probes or other structural changes and you claim that, that would give you a pass. On the other hand, to say that it's the information they encode would seem to allow defendants to say, well, you know, those changes, those structural changes are the equivalent of post-solution activity.
Right.
They're clever chemistry, if not clever claim drafting, and it's the information that matters. And so, again, we move the line, and it's the if it's information that matters, then you know, then any, whether genomic or other forms of genetic-based composition still become unpatentable. Your thoughts on that?
I think that's exactly right. I think that's what I kind of tried to highlight when I talked about Justice Thomas's analysis. How his analysis is somewhat was weirdly different between isolated DNA and cDNA. After all, again, the information they carry is by and large the same. And yet, so he's almost peremptorily says cDNA is patent eligible because it's just, it was altered. And then he comes right back to the paragraph that you just highlighted that that again talks about information that the DNA encodes. So, again, so reading it for... My point is that these are inconsistent. I think you're exactly right, because with DNA sequencing being almost routine now, where any qualified undergraduate student, much less a graduate student, can do it, it may be very easily argued that actual creation of cDNA from isolated DNA is almost insignificant post-solution activity. And so precisely because it encodes for the same material. So that's another one of those instances where the opinion is somewhat inconsistent, internally inconsistent, and it's unclear what the court is focusing on. Is they focusing on information, i.e. the function of DNA, or are they focusing on its molecular structure? And what worries me about it is not so much DNA, because, again, Human Genome Project, after all, was completed 10 years ago. So we actually, we're sort of way beyond what Myriad has been trying to do here. A lot of gene sequences are known. Not all the functions are known, but sequences, DNA has been sequenced, and creating cDNA out of it is somewhat routine. What worries me is that if this language is applied to future developments in biologics and biological treatments, if the Supreme Court or lower courts are going to start saying that, you know, that certain biologic is not patent eligible because it looks and acts the same as a compound produced by that should have been produced by the body, but it's not being produced because of some sort of disease that you have. So for example, is synthetic insulin that varies only very little from natural insulin, is that now going to be patent ineligible because it carries the same function, same information to the body that you should start doing certain things, that your body should start doing certain things with your sugar? Or will it remain patent eligible? I think, you know, my position is should be self-evident that, of course, I think synthetically created insulin should be patent eligible. But if one takes seriously some of the sentences in Justice Thomas's opinion, that perhaps could be an open question. And so that worries me.
Thank you.
Our lines are completely open at this point. If you have a question for Professor Greg Dolan, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see if there are any more questions. Professor, let me ask you, during your preparation for this call, I know you've been reading the opinion. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at any of the popular press coverage of this, but they almost universally seem to be reporting that the court has ruled that human genes cannot be patented. I don't think you think the case goes that far. I'm wondering if you have a reaction to that, if there's why popular press might be getting it wrong, what effects that might have on the lower courts as they maybe struggle with this case. If you want to say something about that.
Well, I don't know what effect we'll have on the lower court. I hope that judges, when they're faced with actual real cases, will read U.S. reports and not New York Times in trying to arrive. But certain impressions may very well be formed, and they're kind of in almost involuntary. And so when judges hear a case for the first time, their kind of first impression was, well, didn't I hear something about the Supreme Court said that things like this cannot be patented. And so that's problematic. The reason why I think the court is doing it is because, well, I think there are several reasons. One, I think so the plaintiff in this case are actually celebrating this as a victory. It's perhaps some of the art of spin. And some of it is that it goes back to this very beginning of my discussion in the House. Supreme Court even phrased the question. They asked, are human genes patentable? And again, everybody agrees that human genes are not patentable. Nobody, even Greg Castanis, who argued for Myriad, who took a fairly strong position that, and fairly broad position that 101 should be a bar to almost nothing. He was, I think, at some point during oral argument, he was asked, well, could human liver be patentable? And he didn't say unequivocally no. He tried just to explain the situation where it could be patentable. So, Myriad took a very strong position that 101 is a very, very, very porous sieve. But even Myriad didn't argue that human genes as they are in the body are patent eligible. So, given the fact that the Supreme Court now has said, well, of course human genes are not patent eligible, you know, the question that nobody ever disputed, I think that's what newspapers are picking up, and they're not looking at the sort of finer detail between native DNA, cDNA, and DNA that actually is in the body before it gets excised.
Very good. Last call for questions. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. Pause here and see if anybody's ringing in with a question. Star button and the pound button. I don't want to cut anybody off. But, Professor, it looks like you've answered all the questions. We've got quite a few people on the call, so they're all hanging in here till the end.
Right.
Let me thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society for joining the call, especially on such short notice. We certainly appreciate you taking a look at the opinion and giving us your opinion on that opinion.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure, and I appreciate everybody who called in and asked questions, and hopefully I was able to shed some light on the decision and the history of this case.
And to the audience, I invite you to check the Federalist Society's website for a schedule of upcoming calls, a reminder that we will quite likely have a call on Monday to be determined on whatever emerges from the Supreme Court on its next decision day, Monday. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.